I've been so looking forward to introducing you to our next guest. He's our Bookmarks interviewee today, Distinguished Professor of English, Brian Boyd, widely recognised as the world's leading scholar on the Russian-American writer Vladimir Nabokov. Last year, he was awarded the Rutherford Medal by the Royal Society, Te Aparangi, the first time the award has included the humanities. And he retired from the University of Auckland last year to focus on writing books, but he's generously given us some of his time today. Hi there, Brian.
Hi there, Jesse.
Nice to talk to you. And I mentioned this earlier. I sort of, quote, discovered you through Jamie Loftus's Lolita podcast. Have you had a few people around the world get in contact after hearing you on that?
Actually, no. It's funny. I was on a Zoom call to France the other day because I was involved in a documentary on Lolita that aired just about a week ago, a brilliant French documentary. But we had a Zoom conference about it by some of the people involved in the documentary and some others who from the French Nabokov Society. And one of my former supervisees said that she was on the Jamie Loftus podcast and was contacted by all sorts of people, but nobody contacted me. Maybe I belong to a category of people who are too old to listen to podcasts. I don't
know. Yeah. You were very good in the podcast. Have you listened to the podcast, by the way?
I listened to some of it, and I couldn't stand myself, so I didn't listen to any more.
As someone who knows nothing about Nabokov, I found it really interesting. I presume you agree with the premise of her podcast, which is that Lolita has become something completely different to what Nabokov intended, the point of his book. Not that he would probably admit to having a point of his book, but perhaps the book itself is something quite different to its place in popular culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the point of this documentary, which I think did it even better. It's the far and away the best documentary that's ever been made on Nabokov and on Lolita. And it starts off with a 12-year-old putting on lipstick and dressing sexily and going out as if she's on the hustle. And then it takes the makeup off her and puts her back in a 12-year-old's clothes and shows her as a normal 12-year-old. And it's completely different. It's just a very powerful beginning to the documentary. I mean, that first image is what people have in mind when they think of Lolita as a young seductress. But she's not at all like that. Nabokov was interviewed on French TV by their best-known literary interviewer and who said something about Lolita as a perverse young girl. And Nabokov stopped him right there and said, she is not a perverse young girl. She's just a perfectly normal adolescent who's been abused by an elderly man.
Yeah, she was... She's clearly the victim in the book and also helps to think about the book as the story as being written by the character, not as written by Nabokov. We could spend a whole sort of session just talking about that. I presume that's the book that got you interested in the author in the first place.
Well, no, actually. I mean, well, it failed to. My parents had when I was growing up, my parents left school at 14 in the Depression in Northern Ireland and didn't know how to feed my passion for books. And we had a little corner store where I would check off all the magazines that came in and read them all on the process and file them away according to the subscribers. And I did the same for the bookstore that they then bought as a way of satisfying my passion, and it had a lending library in it. And in the lending library, I noticed Lolita and noticed that it was regarded as a classic and a dirty book. And I was 12 or 13. I thought, well, this sounds interesting. and snuck it home and read it, hiding it under the pillow between reads. But it was way over my head. And let's see, about 4 years later, I was 16, my last year at high school. I was again filing away magazine orders, and there was a Time magazine cover story on Nabokov on the occasion of his latest novel, Ada, which I ended up writing a book about and my PhD thesis about. But there was a little boxed interview in the center of the Time magazine that said, with a headline in red, I have never met a more lonely, more lucid, better balanced mad mind than mine. And everything I read in the interview was just blew me away. So I rushed to the local public library to get the latest available Nabokov novel, which wasn't Ada, but Pale Fire. And that I did read with absolute rapture. I was old enough by now to get it. And it's full of cross-references. And because I trusted Nabokov from the interview, I followed every cross-reference, which gives you clues to all sorts of secrets about the story that you're not supposed to know at the beginning. And it was just an exhilarating process of discovery.
Oh, great. We'll come back to that and some of your other recommends as well. I'm talking to Brian Boyd, Nabokov scholar. Let's just check in with the headlines.
Thanks, Jesse. The alert level for parts of Waikato and King Country will remain at level 3, but with some easing of restrictions following confirmation of 74 new COVID-19 community cases today, down from 79 yesterday. The local government minister says the Three Waters reforms will help rural communities get better access to water services. Consumer New Zealand says the electricity sector needs reform following a review from the Electricity Authority that shows households are effectively subsidising some large corporates. We'll have more news at 3.
Tonight on Nights, Harry McNaughton, co-creator of The Pact, a family TV drama about euthanasia. Gay Buckingham on her new novel for young adults, Kakapo Keeper, based on the pioneer fjordland bird keeper Richard Henry and an imaginary teenage assistant. And speaking of wildlife, this week's Hump Prize is Wild Fathers. What we human dads can learn about bringing up the kids from other male animals, maybe even goats, on Nights after the news at 7 on RNZ National.
I'm with Brian Boyd. We're talking bookmarks, so Brian's chance to choose some music and tell us about a few of his favourite things. And the piece, the first piece of music you've got is Peaches on Regalia. Can you tell us about this one?
Well, this is by Frank Zappa. I've loved Frank Zappa since I discovered him in, what, 69 or 70. I love his edginess, his... He thumbs his nose at almost everything, both musically and intellectually or socially. But he's very, very funny. This piece is from an album called Hot Rats, which is probably the Zappa for people who don't necessarily like anything else that Zappa has done. Mm-hmm. It's a very tightly controlled piece, very strongly jazz influenced. One of the fascinating things for me about music is that interplay between control and the suggestion that you're almost losing control. Well, Zappa, in his Mothers of Invention shows and albums, is always playing with the element of loss of control. There's concrete sounds. A needle might skip over the vinyl, and people will belch and fart, but at the same time he's mixing classical music, rock music, parodies of rock music and jazz. Here it's almost pure jazz, and very, very tightly controlled.
Thank you.
I enjoyed that. Frank Zappa, Peaches on Regalia. If you're interested, by the way, you can. That album was dedicated to Frank's son Dweezil, and Dweezil has done his own version of that song. In fact, he won a Grammy for Best Rock Instrumental. It's the choice of Brian Boyd, Nabokov scholar, and our guest on Bookmarks today. Nabokov is famously a very wordy writer, a word-obsessed writer, Brian, and yet all the tracks you've chosen for us today are instrumentals. It's interesting, isn't it?
Not if you got Rocky Atrare's Bomb Boy.
Okay, hang on, let me have a look. Right, not all of them then, maybe.
Yeah.
can you sum up the genius and the appeal of Nabokov in a nutshell?
Well, Martin Amis, the novelist, is a great fan of Nabokov's, and he says he does all the usual things better than anybody else, and that would be a start. So he's got wonderful characters, intricate plots, very original structures, and just a command of language that has made many people call him the best stylist ever in prose stylist in English, which is quite extraordinary for somebody who was writing in his second language. Just all of his sentences sing, but so there's this dazzling surface, but what attracts me most is that underneath the dazzling surface, if you dive deeper, you find a whole coral reef of life there, and hidden caves with buried treasure. You can go on discovering things in Nabokov inexhaustibly. He was a world-class scientist too. He was the curator of Lepidoptera, of butterflies and moths, at the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology in the 40s, and did work that was not fully recognized until the 1980s and 1990s, when other scientists followed up his lead and have published books on his work as a lepidopterist. And he felt that he wanted to give to his readers of his fiction something akin to the excitement of discovery that he had in working on butterflies, where he discovered new organs in butterflies, discovered reclassified genera and families, and looked at the wing scales on butterflies to a new depth, and so on. He spent 14 hours a day working on at the microscopes when he was at Harvard. Couldn't stop himself.
He includes Easter eggs in his books as well, or we call them Easter eggs.
That's right.
Kind of a modern term. But for the fan, there is stuff there. I think I heard you or someone else in that podcast talking about Lolita. If you look at the names of the hotels, or the names that he chooses to use for things, often are connected or have a theme or reference each other.
Yes. He's got all sorts of ways of hiding things right under your nose so that you can read something carefully, study it for years, and then still find a new joke just buried there right in front of your eyes.
You're here to tell us about a few of your favourite things. You've already mentioned Pale Fire. Tell us about Mouse by Art Spiegelman and why you've included it.
Okay. Well, Mouse is a two-volume graphic novel regarded by many as perhaps the breakthrough graphic novel that showed how serious the graphic novels could be. It was published in installments between 1979 and 1990. It tells the story of Art Spiegelman's surviving Auschwitz. It presents visually the Jews as mice and the Germans as cats, and Poles as pigs, and French as frogs, and Swedes as reindeer, and so on. But mostly it's just the mice and the cats. And I just read about it in a New Zealand Herald article and thought, this sounds so fabulous. I went and bought both volumes, read them that same day, and immediately knew I wanted to teach a new course on narrative, a graduate course, and it also helped trigger me into writing my book on the origin of stories, evolution, cognition, and fiction, about why we're a storytelling species. It does so much with storytelling. It manages to because it's using a new medium in such radically different ways, it just opens so many possibilities for understanding about the nature of story. It's part of the structure of the book is Spiegelman's very complicated relationship with his father, Vladek, whose ingenuity, in a way, helped him survive Auschwitz and his wife survive Auschwitz, although, of course, it depended on a sheer amount of luck in that impossible-to-control situation. But it's very moving, of course. It manages to make Auschwitz bring it down to an intimate human scale. And at the same time, it's very funny because of mostly because of the relationship between Art Spiegelman and his father, who is trying to inculcate in Art, who's a little kid who's going to grow up to be a bohemian, the kind of canny, businesslike or sly maneuvers that enabled him to survive as the Nazis were imposing their will on Poland, where they lived, and in Auschwitz itself.
Hey, great recommend. It's a graphic novel and it's called Maus, M-A-U-S. How about the Museum of Innocence, Brian?
Orhan Pamuk is my favourite living novelist. I debated whether to select the Museum of Innocence or A Stranger's in My Mind, which perhaps I like even more, but the Museum of Innocence is an extraordinary book that starts with a very, very erotic love scene between the hero and his beloved, but their love is basically thwarted through all the rest of the novel. And she dies, and the hero and narrator of the novel sets up a museum full of little objects. At one point, he's the love of his life. His relationship with her breaks down for reasons that are perhaps a bit complicated to tell now. But she marries somebody else, and she's living with her parents in Istanbul. And he goes and visits the family every night and steals something as a memento, like her cigarette butts with her lipstick on, or just little trinkets. He's very rich. He doesn't need to steal anything, but he steals them as mementos of his conversations with her. Well, mostly with her parents, because she won't talk to him all that much. This goes on for 8 years. He's obsessively visiting them. And he gradually, because he's wealthy enough, he can build a museum of all these things he's stolen and other artifacts that encapsulate the life of Istanbul at the time. And Pamuk had the idea several years before beginning the novel of himself creating a museum of the life, a small-scale museum of the life of Istanbul, which he writes about obsessively in so many different ways, over so many different centuries, so many different topics, politics, art, the settling of the city in the 1950s to the 2000s, when it moved from being a town of 1 million people to nearly 20 million today. And with his Nobel Prize money, he realized he could actually build this museum. So he has built a museum which has all and he built it he bought the land, the house, before he started writing the novel. So the novel is actually set in the house that he bought and was in the process of turning into a museum. And he interweaves fact and fiction and local colour and these individual details so intricately, both in the novel and in the museum, which I was going to visit in March last year until COVID got in the way. I was going to actually give a lecture at a university in Istanbul with Orhan Pamuk, who we're friends, introducing me. So it would have been fun, but another time.
Wonderful. Yeah, I think you're going to create a queue for that one at the library, Brian, the Museum of Innocence.
There's actually in the book, in the novel, right near the end, there's a little ticket to the museum. So if you show that, you can get in for free. And he's done a documentary about it. He's done a catalogue of the museum, and they're all fascinating from so many different angles.
You've got so many great choices here. I want to make sure we get to as many of them as possible. You're a big movie fan, I understand. So this would have been a tough challenge for you to pick a few to talk about, but maybe should we talk about The Fast Runner, or Najwat?
Yes. So this is a story that appealed to me. I was already teaching my graduate course in narrative and interested in the commonalities in narrative over the centuries and over different cultures. And this was the first movie made in an Inuit language in 2001. It tells an Inuit story of about, they think, 1,000 years ago. It's full of truth to the ethnographic record, and yet it seems timeless and modern at the same time. The emotions, the love, trust, envy, revenge, forgiveness, they're all so powerful. It's a wonderful adventure story, and very, very moving. At the same time, as one of the motivations for the producers and those, the scriptwriters and so on, was to show Inuit life as it was, and all the skills that were involved in adapting to this extreme environment that were being lost to younger generations of Inuit. So it shows you how to kill a seal and to use the skin and ice to make runners for a sled, and it's just a fascinating mix. It's a 3-hour movie, and I saw it at the film festival, and just on my own, because my wife wasn't really interested in seeing a 3-hour movie. So then it was being shown one other time the next day, so I dragged her along, and of course she loved it too.
So you were not only interested in seeing a 3-hour movie, you were interested in seeing it twice.
Yep.
Great. You've also got Tokyo. Oh, so that one was probably the easiest way to search for it if you're an English speaker, is The Fast Runner. It does have an Inuit title as well. What about Tokyo Story?
Okay, this is by Yasujirō Ozu, who I have friends who are I regard as the best film critics in the world. And I asked them what their favorite director was, and they're a husband and wife couple who writes both separately and together, and they both agreed that Ozu was their favorite. Tokyo Story is his best known, 1953. It's just a story of a family of two parents who live apart from most of their children in a small town in western Japan, going to visit their children in Tokyo Story, who are basically feel that they're too busy to look after them. And it's the daughter-in-law of their son, who was killed in the war, who really cares for them, even though she's got less money than the others of their children. There are so many unique features about the way Ozu makes films. He had the same group of actors again and again. Chishu Ryu was in his films from the late 1930s to into the 60s in about 50 of his films. And he always made Ryu pare down his emotions so that less and less was being seen on the face. And that's it's very, very, a very still kind of movie. And every shot is sublimely realistic and understated. And at the same time, it's also exquisitely framed. There's a kind of beautiful symmetry to every shot that he has that makes each moment a little work of art. It's full of tiny little domestic details that seem to be going nowhere, as in most of his movies. And And then gradually, about two-thirds of the way through the movie, you realize it's adding up to the biggest questions. And in this case, death and whether we've been kind enough to people in the face of death. And it really, you know, it becomes just very, very emotionally powerful.
Great. It'll take a bit of finding. It's called Tokyo Story. We're chatting to Brian Boyd. We're going to play you another track now. Brian, you've chosen something from J.S. Bach. Tell us, why this track?
Well, I love all of Bach's music. I think if I was on a desert island and I had one composer, it probably would be Bach. He's so diverse, but he never disappoints. Everything is just exquisite, even when he's showing you how to practice on a violin or a cello. The sonatas and partitas are just sublime music, even though they're practice pieces. But this particular piece is from the Brandenburg Concerti, which are probably the greatest of his non-religious music. And I think it was the first piece of classical music that I ever really fell in love with. It was the soundtrack to a short movie. And I must have been, I was in my late teens, mid to late teens. And it's just an exhilarating piece of music. It's so upbeat, and it was being played against something that was becoming more and more gruesome on the screen. Mm. Wonderful ironies. And this particular track is played by Wynton Marsalis, and that was something else that I wanted to include. Marsalis is probably the world's best trumpet player, both in classical and in jazz music, and he's got Grammys for both, and that's so unusual. And he values each of them very, very highly, although I think he's got a softer spot for jazz. But to have somebody at the very top level of performance in both fields, and also he composes his own work, validating the other field is for me very important.
Great, well said. This is the Brandenburg Concerto No. 2 in F major. Thank you. I love that I have some classical music on in the afternoon. J.S. Bach, chosen by Brian Boyd, who's been picking a few of his favourite things. Can we mention, we've got just a couple of minutes before the 3 p.m. news. Brian, I wanted to make sure that we mention Hokusai. Can you tell us about, this is a painter?
Yes, yes. He's Japan's greatest painter, I think. He was famous for doing ukiyo-e prints, which were regarded as cheap prints done in mass-produced in the 1810s to the 1840s or 50s. He lived to be 90, and he was still improving at 90. He undertook not a Sistine Chapel ceiling, but a very large ceiling at 89. And one of my favourite paintings by him is, I think, from his 89th year. It's called Tiger in the Snow, and it shows this tiger who is incredibly soft in the snow. And there are you all know the great wave off Kanagawa, which is the most famous image in Oriental art. But this is even more lovely. This tiger who looks like as soft as snow. He's got a smile that's so benign, and he's running uphill in the snow effortlessly, almost flying. And there are branches of a fir tree that hang down with snow on them, but the little pointed branches, the ends of the branches, look like his claws, which are also somehow look soft. He's just playing with your expectations, and pattern upon pattern is what he does in work after work, which is why I selected the Great Wave of Kanagawa and some other images for this exhibition I organised in the on the origin of art in Hobart, Tasmania.
Great. I'm going to ask people they can probably Google and have a look at Tiger in the Snow. It is a lovely image. And unfortunately, you and I are out of time, but I really enjoyed our chat. Thank you, Brian. Hopefully we can find an excuse to get back here soon.